And welcome to The Thread. I am your host. Tonight, we have a show on the butchering of pop music, along with the onset of the peer-to-peer music era. Our main guest, who will talk us through this curious landscape of sound art projects, new breeds of music, technological breakthroughs, and the violence done to chart hits.
And at the same time, peer-to-peer became popular, mainly with Napster. People might recognize Napster, which was basically making pirate music accessible online. Right. So we're talking about pirated music, mainly copied from CDs and stuff.
And just to put some context around that, the idea of something being pirated was something that was relatively new with the onset of the peer-to-peer network phenomenon. Is that right?
I don't think so, because we always had like mixtapes, things recorded from the radio and, you know, copies. But what peer-to-peer actually does is transform the end products, as it were, the CDs, vinyls, whatever, into digital files. And it makes MP3 a standard format.
Okay.
So there are two main consequences. One, the digital files become like widely accessible, copyable. It's really easy to make a copy of, which means they're considered to be disposable in a way, and this not in the same way as the end product. You know, you take care of your CDs, you don't want it to scratch and things like that. Mm. Whereas digital file, you just throw away and get a new one or copy as you like. So this is one thing. And the other thing, which was really important for the peer-to-peer sort of effect on the whole music industry, is the listener. You know, this sort of dichotomous relation, listener and music producer. So basically like the consumer and the producer, that goes down the drain basically, because the listener becomes the sharer of music, which kind of embodies all the functions. The sharer stores music, distributes, listens to, so consumes, and also becomes a producer, when it's really easy to process these digital files, which are then raw material, basically, through whatever software you have in your computer. Well, hang on, you know, there's all this material available. Let's just grab it and do, you know, what we want with it.
And it was just all these kind of really harsh, completely unrecognizable remixes of rap music, basically. And these are all people coming from either the kind of rave techno scene or a kind of disillusionment with the rave techno scene in, and people who have a kind of informed understanding of software and open source programming and those kind of things, and okay, experimental music, really.
So is this part of the way that this works, is that people have to have a certain amount of technological savvy to sort of even get in on the game?
Well, this is actually my kind of second reflection on this whole premise, which is it wasn't even just geographic, but there was a whole revolution in the tools that were available as well. So not only music was being exchanged, but also software and readily available software of different complexities. I mean, there was really primitive kind of cut and splice software like Sound Edit or
Cool Edit,
I think, was its first version. So everything from that to things like Max MSP or Super Collider, which were, you know, completely modular, and you could basically build the equivalent of analog equipment from the ground up. But you could build it however you wanted to.
Right. So you're saying modular in that they give you pieces that you could then combine.
Right.
And make
bigger
and bigger.
And these are open
machines.
Source systems, so you make an FM synthesis algorithm, and then you can also share that and build that and use that as a module in your larger kind of audio system.
But something like Max MSP, that's not open source anymore. Did it start out as open source?
Well, actually, I mean, that's kind of a slightly different story, but Max MSP, when it was being developed by Miller Perquet, was supposed to be open source, was supposed to be shareable and free.
Didn't Earthcam have something to do with it?
Well, he was a researcher for Earthcam, and he actually went on. What he did is, because when he found out that they were going to, well, this is an apocryphal story, but when he found out that they were going to try to package it and sell it as a product, he created an alternative called Pure Data. Well, it's called PD, which can be interpreted as Pure Data or public domain, which I think is kind of nice as well. But PD is remains open source and free.
I think what's in the very basic level, which is not necessarily, you know, for people technologically savvy or software experts, as it were, is that, well, there was this local thing as well. VVM really places themselves, the whole project, in the north of England, okay. as opposed to what was happening in London, okay. a mainstream, like experimental, so-called experimental labels that were emerging at the time. But what I think it happens sort of across the board internationally is the fact that has in the music industry, not only the software, the pirated software, but mainly the music as the digital files. And around, you know, 99, 2000, right in the middle of this euphoria, this big euphoria with the internet, and also the apocalyptical, like the millennium bug or the
yes.
Y2K bug.
Yes, like, which is going to end it all. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, oh my God, we're all lost, you know.
Our bank accounts, our mortgages.
Or even like, oh, our debts would be free and stuff.
Yes, this is what it would look like when we're free, yeah.
And that sort of applied to the music industry as well. P2P, mm-hmm. you know, and file sharing basically was seen as a threat and a crisis of, you know, this established music network, meaning how music got distributed, stored, and, you know, the actual relationship established.
And it still is, though, in a lot of ways. I mean, people are still dealing with it. You know, it hasn't gone away, so we can't talk about it in the past tense.
Yeah. But you mean the falling of the music industry? Mm. Yeah.
I like I hadn't thought about it in terms of the Y2K bug, and actually I kind of like the idea of thinking of it as bunkered pop as well, because, you know, people were actually building bunkers for the Y2K disaster.
Yes.
And I think that's a really nice kind of parallel to the kind of bedroom production style that was emerging as well. Like, people, you know, you didn't need a sound studio anymore. It was just you and your laptop in your bedroom. And that was something that the record industry really couldn't account for. It was like, what are these people doing in their bedrooms, and how can we stop it? And it was like a bunker. It was like a bunker
mentality.
Pop.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, like, the only way that it's going to be saved is if I save it myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the main thing it makes. Because before, I mean, we're not saying before peer-to-peer there weren't music online.
Right.
You know, these things were circulating. But basically, you had a contract. You were a client and you had a contract with the server. So you asked the sort of channel of information was controlled, and the access as well was controlled. And after that, basically, well, peer-to-peer makes everyone, it decentralizes, so it makes everyone both client and server. So you share without having this, you know, like this entity basically controlling what you're sharing and with. So it makes like large areas, it puts them in the shade, in the dark for the music industry in a way.
Yeah, and I want to ask, I guess, what they think or how they think the music industry has responded to this, because it seems to me, like Nathan just said, that that it is still a crisis, that record companies and labels, they're shedding money. And I read accounts, various newspapers, every other day, it seems, that such and such a person has been shuffled as such and such a label. They're trying new administrative schemes, trying basically to get back to where they were 20, 30 years ago when they were making money hand over fist. I mean, my sense of it is that they still are, but not quite as much. But can maybe you can talk about, from what you know, about how the record industry has responded, if they have, to this kind of work.
I don't think I could possibly answer that question. I could be a bit apocalyptic about
it.
Well, I think that they're failing, and they're going to keep failing until, you know, they change their business models, as it were. But far be it from me to actually
maybe
give
even
them a model.
Their entire product, like changing the whole form of their product. Mm. It plays on the kind of naivete of pop music, but also perverts that in a really kind of sinister way. Like, there's definitely like a kind of grinning cat behind it all. Like, we're taking these kind of extremely polished plastic products and making them sinister.
I mean, there is a part of it that when someone could read this as sort of mean-spirited, like, you know that these icons, whatever you think of them, that they're sort of these sacred cows to these 12, 13-year-olds, right?
Absolutely.
They're important to them in some ways. And you're just taking them and sort of, you know, ripping them to shreds in front of them and
gleefully.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
with really, really fast drums.
Okay, all right. At some point, we're going to have to listen to some of this music to give them an example of what Volume versus Mass or some of these other groups sound like. But before we do that, Leandro, can you talk a little bit about what some of these other groups that were around while Volume versus Mass was doing its thing?
Yeah, sure. Well, this it's a bit, a lot of things were anonymous, actually, or people use, you know, different names, different pseudonyms. So one person producing music could have like 10, 50 names even.
Okay.
What VVM does, which I think is important, is actually formalize it in a certain way, you know, through the butchering, which is really... It can be taken as a metaphor for destruction and hacking of music, but I think it's a bit more than that. It actually, like, proliferating pop music, as we were saying, the you know, the appropriation of this is not sort of is not dark or goth. It's okay. Out of affirmation.
Okay.
There's even a bit of we were sort of debating this before. There's even a bit of love, you know, towards the pop hits. Is like, well, actually, this is a track I love, but it wouldn't look good if I listened to this.
It was straight.
Yeah,
there's
a karaoke element to it.
Karaoke, definitely, yeah.
And then you can almost hear them learning how to use the software.
Fantastic.
Over the course of different albums until it has become like this very polished, very complex format, which is really not that much different than kind of some of the mainstream, well, like Aphex Twin, which is one of the kind of main targets of early VVM music, at least.
Okay.
You're dead tonight. I've never seen you shine so bright. Never seen so many men ask you if you wanted to dance. Looking for a little romance. Give out half a chance. I have never seen that dress you're wearing. All the highlights in your hair that catch your eye. I've been blind, lady in red. Is dancing with me. She won't let you know. There's nobody here. It's just you and me. It's where I wanna be. But I hardly know.
Hello, welcome back to The Thread. We're in studio with Leandro Cardoso, and we were just talking with him about his project concerning Volume versus Mass and groups that butcher pop music and the peer-to-peer music revolution. The track that we were just listening to, Leandro, can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, it was Lady in Red is Dancing with Meat. And that was one of the early butchered songs. Okay. By VVM. So it might seem really arbitrary and easy to do, but at the same time, there's a clear target in the pop hits, which is not, you know, this sort of gratuitous attack. It's more like creating new breeds of pop music and actually proliferating it.
Well, I mean, I remember that song from high school. And I think that this version is an improvement on that. Can you give us, maybe you can tell us about another track and then we'll get a chance to listen to it. Something that's sort of representative of that kind of, you know, that you actually care about the music. You're actually creating a kind of new sort of thing by manipulating it.
Okay, the next one we're going to play is actually a lot earlier, and it's by John Oswald, this guy who, another, again, sort of formalized this kind, this approach to music. And he's the so-called creator of Plunderphonics. And Plunderphonics is this collage approach to music, and he really specified piracy as a prerogative, basically, for music composition.
So it's something that you should be doing.
Yeah, definitely.
And right. And it's kind of indicated in the song titles as well. Like this one is called DAB, which is the reversal of Michael Jackson's Bad. And I mean, I kind of gave it away there, but it's kind of important to understand, like, the first half of this 6-minute track is just ambient. Because he takes, it's these very tight tape loops of just like the first utterances of the song. You know, it's really, I mean, you kind of get a sense for it if, when we play it, but it's, it kind of, it really, really breaks down, like breaks down the boundaries of what kind of constitutes a pop song, I think.
Great.
I think what is really interesting about this this approach to music is that establishes like an intimate relation to the pop song, and in this weird way to the pop star as well, which is kind of the opposite that the music industry tried to do, which was trying to sort of put layers and layers in between, you know, the listener and the music.
But I also think it what the pop industry tries to do is sort of, well, manage our response to music and to the star. Like
bureaucratizes.
Bureaucratizes our response so that the responses tend to be the same. It's all just awe. It's all just, you know, what I like about what's interesting to me about this track is that it makes me focus my attention on a little bit of the music, so my response is a bit more, I don't know, considered, I suppose. Does that make sense?
Does it make sense, Tim?
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I feel like it's a very conflicted relationship in a way. Okay. It's I think that everybody involved in this kind of music has grown up with pop. And they have, it's like a love-hate kind of relationship, because you're also making music and consuming it at the same time. And so it's a sliding scale of what you think you're, I mean, it's not a contribution. It is, it's a unique thing you're doing with the material, but it, it kind of slides in and out of its own voice and your voice.
Okay.
And that voice, in, at least in the context of EVM and John Oswald and a lot of kind of Plunderphonics also, groups like Stockhausen and Walkman or the or Negative Land, they have a very antagonistic relationship with their source material.
Okay. Are we going to be able to hear some of that?
Yeah, we've got some tracks like that.
Great, great. Because I would love for the audience to hear that contrast.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what sets them apart from a standard kind of remix or tribute or mashup even.
Okay.
You know, it's that antagonistic relationship with pop music, where they're kind of undermining it and subverting it, and not, it's not just a kind of a new sound. It's like a new, harsh kind of... I don't even know, like...
Okay, but this goes beyond, like, Cake redoing I Will Survive, right?
Yeah.
Like, I
mean, yeah,
okay,
yeah,
okay,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Okay, all right. Your own track, Leandro.
Yeah. Mine and
so I think,
a friend.
I think Mischief was the word I was looking for. Mischief or Mayhem.
Okay, there you go.
Around that time, you know, 1999, 2000, what it happens, like, the music industry generalizes criminalization.
Or, yeah, there you go. Criminalization,
yeah. Yeah, so basically everyone who shares music online, free music, copied, is a criminal.
Yes.
And also that, you know, the that take it sort of sets a precedent for a lot of legal cases against peer-to-peer and against file sharing. And that's where we end up having to pay taxes when you buy a blank CD, because your potential you know,
crime.
Yeah. Criminal. It was like that with cassette tapes, though, wasn't it? To pay taxes on cassette tapes. Yeah,
always. But I didn't realize
sort
that
of managed to.
I do think that's changing, though. That, I mean, it's taking a different form, like the moralization of file sharing. Crook with that, but you know, like people more and more are giving away their studio albums for free.
Yeah. Prince, for example.
So I mean, it is slowly changing.
Yeah,
but you know, even the nomenclature is really interesting, because it's called file sharing, right? So there's something already sort of built into the ways that we talk about it that are more that are cued towards, oh, we're doing something nice for each other.
Well, pirating that's sharing, but a whole different version.
There
of
you
it,
go.
It?
Right. So depends on who's talking
that.
About
people
it.
People have embraced it. I mean, the Pirate Bay. I mean,
okay.
That's the, you know, the one of the sites to go to get your BitTorrent. It's a BitTorrent.
But Pirate Bay is certainly distinguished from, say, iTunes paid downloads, or even the new generation of Napster. I mean, there's like a boundary of legitimacy that they kind of transgress.
I think that's
but celebrate.
That goes back to your, sorry to interrupt. That goes back to your question, like, what's the answer? How did the music industry
respond
to that?
Right.
I think the first instance was this, oh my God, this is going to ruin us.
Panic.
Let's block it.
Yes.
Let's find a way of blocking this thing.
Yes, absolutely.
And
shut
the second is, you know, now, like, looking back from today, like how iTunes evolved and the whole, you know, like, selling tracks, single tracks, and even musicians who invite you to, you know, write part of the lyrics online and invite you to design the cover online, and then you print your own cover. All this sort of user friendliness and participation, the interaction, so-called interaction, which was, you know, a realization, a late realization that this thing, you know, could not be stopped, basically. So this is the sort of enclosure of the technology. You make you make them yours in a way, and part you get a profit out of it.
Yeah. I saw you to steal your participation.
Yeah, right. Definitely.
The latest Franz Ferdinand album, I remember they had this kind of set up in a gallery in near Piccadilly. I went to it like last year, and they had a drum set up, and they told you to interpret different fragments of James Joyce's Ulysses. I remember sitting there really eagerly going at it, going, I'm going to be on a Franz Ferdinand single. And then halfway through, I felt really ill, like they were stealing my improv skills. Not that there's any there, really, to be honest.
David Bowie was a really pioneer in this, because in 98, he set up BowieNet, which was basically like his own like content provider. You know, he became a server, basically. Hmm. And all his stuff was online.
David Bowie was obsessed with the internet.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But, you know, you're talking about late realizations. He's one of those people who made a very early realization and actually sold the rights to all of his music within, I think, the same month that Napster went up. Like, he knew what was going on. He knew. He was completely aware of the whole peer-to-peer thing and its implications for his music.
So he sold the rights.
He auctioned it.
Jesus.
And made probably, you know, 10 times as much as he would have a few weeks later.
And then BowieNet, you subscribe and you pay monthly. So you pay, I think,
he's
nowadays
also the first...
it's $65, I think, you pay monthly.
He was also
and
the,
you have access to, like, exclusive videos, and you get to chat with him online.
That's that kind fantastic.
Of he's a fully integrated internet node.
I love it.
He was the first artist to also release a single exclusively on the internet, I think.
Okay, so the node is a play on nerd, right?
Okay,
I'm getting that right. Yeah. Okay, but it's node is in... whatever node stand.
Well, in peer-to-peer, I mean, it's like that's the network. Is every piece of the network is a node.
Yeah, because okay. Instead of having like client a server, so you access a server as a client under a contract, basically, you are nodes or peers.
If I got to play, I'ma play till I win. If I get to be here, get to play till the end. Wanna fuck, shorty can't stand, shorty friend.
Okay, so it sounds to me like, yeah, I mean, I recognize DMX's voice, but it sounds to me like they're also playing with the whole scratching vibe, and DMX really, his music isn't known for that. So it's sort of like they're playing something that sort of came before him, mixing it with him, stuff that came after. Is that right? Am I correct in that?
I think like an important differentiation to make is butchering or butcher is not a style, as Plunderphonics maybe considered to be.
If you wanted to talk about it in aesthetic terms, I mean, it's kind of abstract. But if you think about pop music and listening to radio in general, it's usually highly compressed.
Okay.
And there's this kind of very even dynamic range
of
what happens in pop music and what happens when you listen to the radio. And there's only a certain number of highs and a certain number of lows, and it's usually very even rhythmically over time. But by taking these songs and putting them through these kind of software manipulations, and like some of the major, I mean, I think if you could just hear in that small piece, like one of the main things he did was just turn the volume way up.
Yes.
And so you get this distortion and this dynamic range, which is just immediately kind of grabs you because you're expecting something very flat and you just get huge peaks.
Mm-hmm. And also
that in itself is an aesthetic that's very intentional.
Yeah, it also has to do with the format. MP3 is already a compression. File compression.
That's right.
So
the dynamic range is already reduced. Is that correct?
It's already been kind of crushed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it means a lighter file, so it's quicker to share, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it would take a long time to transfer from one computer to the other.
But then also playing with the kind of recognizability of the of the voice, especially with kind of celebrity pop music. You know, the most kind of immediate form of critique would be to take that voice and stretch it and cut it and and kind of like crumple it up into a ball and throw it.
Right.
And I think that that happens a lot in this song, and it, at one point it just completely dissolves and comes back, you know, and it's about having control over the singer rather than the pop product having control over your experience of it, which is you've kind of recapitulated as well.
That's right. I mean, what it does is it seems to me that it really challenges this notion of what it is to be a consumer, because you're not passive, right? You're not just sitting there accepting the image in the way that it's been packaged for you, or accepting the voice or accepting the song. I mean, none of it.
That's what I mean by establishing this really intimate relationship. It plays on the memory as well, because it sort of expects you to remember how the original is actually in the first place.
Yeah.
So you can understand what's being done and how it was changed, and you know, you get the joke basically.
Yeah, one of the other kind of antagonisms, I mean, talking about, you know, being an active kind of consumer producer and this kind of paradox, is that I mean, I often think about like the kind of learning curve that it takes to get into the production mode. I mean, everybody's very fluent in how to consume, but it's this transition into production which is what I think makes it really interesting. And when you start downloading all these programs and kind of teaching yourself, there is a learning curve. I mean, there's the really basic programs that allow you to make kind of cheap techno really quickly with like Fruity Loops, something like that. But if you want to teach yourself Max or Super Collider, it's a pretty steep learning curve. I mean, if you're smart, you can kind of get going in a few weeks. But I think it takes, you know, 6 months to really start making something interesting. But in response to that, I think there's also a kind of attraction to cheap very kind of dumb electronics. And so I think a lot of the same groups, or at least within the same circles, there was this kind of, on the one hand, using Max MSP and building your own sequencers and building your own sampler
which is really hard. Yeah.
And then, but using toy instruments as your sound source, or using really kind of gritty, you know, kind of punk sources, you know, just like raw field recordings and like. Corrupt toys and, you know, TV samples.
There's a similar movement in the visual art world, right? It's kind of called lo-fi, which is basically you're using available materials, things that you would find around the quote-unquote average home, to make work that you then present in a very refined setting.
There's also the idea, well, in the late 90s was quite popular, the DIY in fashion and everything, you know, people like customizing clothes and stuff like that.
Well, and also with digital production, there was, I think, a lot of, with the power that brought, I think there was a lot of, what's the word, reverence for it. You know, you got these very kind of futuristic, reverent, almost apocalyptic techno ambient producers. And then there's these guys who are just like, I can't stand this. We've got to bring some humor and some insanity to this.
Yes.
And there's almost like an infantilism to it too. Like toy instruments, loud noises, bad rhythms, like, you know, bad harmonies. And it's just like rejection of all of that, saying like, look, no, this is just another, it's just another tool. It's just another toy. This is like a, you know, a fantasy.
And also you have sort of the license of making a fool of yourself, you know, by singing with stupid voices.
And there's an anonymity because you're in this huge crowd, this invisible crowd of the internet.
And even when you release the music, you're allowed to do it under a pseudonym.
But you can build and you can build modularly all kinds of things. Anything from like a simple filter that would, you know, change the texture of your voice or the texture of a sample, to, you know, a full editing suite if you really wanted to. And the appeal of that is that it can imitate things that you can buy either analog or in software packages, but it's infinitely manipulated. You can change it to kind of suit your needs perfectly.
Okay.
And some people don't actually require that much.
On the other hand, you have the like punk approach of, you know, playing two notes kind of thing.
Yes.
Like for instance, I only know to cut and paste and apply filters, which I don't fully understand how they work. But it's try and error, basically, and chance. There's a lot of chance built into it. Yeah. If it sounds, it might sound, you know, it might end up sounding interesting. It might end up sounding crap, but you can just throw it away. There's no, you know, sort of preciousness.
Which is another thing I think that's gone out of the music industry is like the sense that, Nathan, you had mentioned before when you would buy tapes or something that you know, there was this object you really kind of wanted to hold on to. I think buying vinyl records, we had a show. Our first show was actually on vinyl records and how in some ways they become this sort of precious commodity because they are a sort of a record of where you were in your life when you bought that.
Well, they're sensual in a way. That,
yes.
That of MP3 isn't.
It's not.
File sharing isn't very
right.
sexy.
Right. It's very disposable for an era, a generation that continues to be described as disposable. Right.
Now, before we say goodnight, I'd like to thank everybody for being here.
I'll tell you this, Paul, that tracks and dang near talking it, talking it, scout fell off.
Oh, come on. It's too late for you two to start that routine. Pa, will you wind things up with our favorite?
Yeah, Pa, please.
It's my favorite. I'll be glad to.
Oh, place where I wish. Is the wide open space built by the hand of the Lord? Where the trees are like pipes on an organ. And the breeze plays an amen chord.
Peer-to-peer definitely marks a radical infrastructural breakthrough in technology because of this relation. It changes the relation basically between, again, client server and like everybody being peers. And that's not, we've been talking about music because it's sort of preceded and even rehearsed what happened to films. Yeah. Now I think is the big worry, you know, like everyone downloads films and just watching your computer or you have a data projector.
I've just been given a note by our studio engineer saying that we need to say our thank yous and get out of town. So I'm going to do that right now. I really, really appreciate Leandro Cardoso. Nathan, please tell me your surname.
It's Nathan Budzinski.
Thank you. And Tim Iverson for being our guest tonight.